Okay, I think we'll kick off. Thanks everyone for joining us today. The Australian Treasury recently revealed that natural disasters cost the Australian economy $2.2 billion just in the first 5 months of 2025, with Cyclone Alfred and floods across New South Wales and Queensland significantly slowing retail trade and household spending. So in this context, this figure really underscores why climate adaptation isn't just an environmental imperative or a nice to have. It's a critical business and economic challenge. And today we have a fantastic panel of experts who will discuss these challenges, insights and examples of building resilience and adaptation and while adaptation's needed across all sectors of society, and we want to acknowledge there's a lot being done by the public sector in this area, today we're focusing on the commercial lens to climate adaptation. We're going to be examining the barriers and the business case for climate adaptation from the perspective of businesses. And so let me introduce our experts. We have Alison Drill, who is Head of PNC Structured Solutions for APAC in Swiss Re, and her areas of expertise include non-traditional PNC reinsurance solutions, optimisation of reinsurance programs, and M&A. Alison has a particular interest in parametric insurance products, natural perils risk transfer solutions, and climate-related insurance. Alison is also a long-serving member of the Institute's Climate and Sustainability Practice Committee, and very lucky for us, she is the Deputy Chair of the CSPC. Fergus Pitt, on my left, leads the Investor Group on Climate Change's Organized Task Force for Climate Adaptation and Resilience. Fergus draws on policy engagement, corporate engagement and investor practice with the ultimate goal of directing capital towards adaptation and resilience. He was co-author of the IGCC's influential paper, Activating Private Investment in Adaptation, which articulates the key actions governments and the finance sector can take to get capital flowing into resilience. Into building the resilience of Australian households, businesses and economies. And finally, last but not least, we have Ben Newell, who is Professor of Behavioural Science in the School of Psychology at UNSW and Director of the UNSW Institute for Climate Risk and Response. Ben's research focuses on the cognitive processes underlying judgment, choice and decision-making. His role in the Institute is to drive an interdisciplinary research agenda, bringing together expertise from behavioural science, climate science, economics and government to address the risks and opportunities of climate change. Ben participates in a very large number of expert advisory committees. To name a few, he's a member of the academic advisory panel of the behavioural economic team of the Australian government and was part of the Chief Medical Officer's Advisory Group for the National Health and Climate Strategy, and also serves on advisory panels for the Institute's Climate and Sustainability Practice Committee, as well as many other. So we're very lucky to have a great selection of experts and to look at this problem from different lenses, individuals, investors and insurers. And so to open up, we thought we'd just ask the audience what sector you're kind of coming at this problem from. Is it insurance? Is it investments? Or are you a homeowner interested in how to adapt? So I guess show of hands for those working in insurance, looking at this problem from an insurance angle. Great. from an investments perspective, does that enter your role? and I guess homeowner or individual interest. Excellent. So let's get started. We wanted to open with Fergus, really asking you from the investor perspective, why is this a problem that investors care about? So what happens if we don't adapt?
Really useful to know really useful to know who's in the room. And I guess as the ambassador for investors, if that's how I'm being described, it's probably worth me being transparent about what the stakes are for big institutional investors. I'm thinking kind of, you know, your superannuation funds, other fund managers who manage quite a lot of capital. If you are a large super fund, you're essentially a universal owner when it comes to the Australian economy. You'll own a little bit of a whole bunch of companies and businesses and projects right across the economy. So you're exposed to risks really wherever they show up, and it's very, very hard to fully divest from risks. It also means that the returns that you generate for your beneficiaries, they roughly correlate to GDP. You know, you might have a bit of outperformance here or underperformance there, but roughly speaking, if the whole economy is growing, you're in a much better position to be able to create returns. The universal owners, our super funds, are invested in Australia and they're invested overseas. And of course, you know, your goal as an investor is to generate long-term absolute returns. You've got a fiduciary duty to manage the risks, climate risks and other kind of risks across the economy. The Investor Group on Climate Change, our members have about $4.6 trillion under management, and they manage those funds on behalf of about 15 million Australians. As I said, super funds, big managers, that's who you should kind of think of us as. And they're invested in Australian businesses. So if Australian businesses are growing, there's good investment opportunities, and that's obviously good for beneficiaries, which is obviously myself, probably most of the people on the panel, most of the people in this room. And as Ramona mentioned up front, we know that climate disruption is already hitting the economy. I think last week or the week before, the ABS announced the quarterly GDP for the March quarter, and the weakness in that GDP they attributed to extreme weather. You know, floods hitting mining operations, so mining shutting down, and then obviously you've kind of got hits to the capital value of assets, whether it's by cyclone or floods or other kinds of problems. And if you look at, say, South Australia or Western Victoria, low rainfall, even drought is hitting productivity. So you've got productivity, capital, and capital kind of costs there. A combination of acute impacts and chronic ongoing impacts. It's happening now, and as we know, it's likely to get worse over time. So drilling down into how that kind of plays out in the kind of financial sector, this is obviously a fairly simplified model, but we think it's kind of quite useful. You know, the more you've got physical damage and disruption related to climate, it flows through businesses and economies in a number of ways. I'll give you a moment to absorb that slide, but what it's seeking to show is that you've got higher insurance costs through a range of dynamics, and that might be that you just pay more for your insurance, or even a lack of availability of premiums. Flows on to costs for higher debt costs, higher cost of equity, both from the dynamics insurance and from the fundamental risk at the top of the system. And overall, that worsened financeability of a business impedes its ability to grow. It may impede the ability of new businesses in an area to start, or they may shut down. And obviously, that is a poor environment in which to invest, or a poor environment to create returns from the investments that you already have. So, obviously, the kind of climate ghost town risk is what we're trying to avoid. And there are ways to do that under the right conditions, which I think we'll get to later. So that's a very quick sketch of why investors care about this and where they're coming from.
Yeah, and it's great you touched on insurance. So we'll move on to Alison and go through Alison from an insurance or reinsurance perspective. What are the main drivers you see pushing the need for adaptation, and what role can reinsurance or insurance, the insurance sector, play?
Thanks. So this is, I don't know if you wanted to change to the slide. The case for insurance and reinsurance is very clear. So there is no question, I think in our mind, that the expectation is that the annual costs of natural disasters, generally driven by climate risk, is in excess of $100 billion US. And that is a reasonable expectation that we're going to see that every year going on now. And that means that there has to be capacity available in the insurance and reinsurance industry. Some of the increase in natural disasters is driven by the increases in exposures, asset values. It's driven by increases in or changes in where people are choosing to live, things like urbanization and actually perhaps choosing to live near the coast or a river or somewhere else that's hurricane exposed, cyclone exposed. But overlying that is a climate change signal. And this is what, from an insurance perspective, is driving an urgent need to adapt, because there will become a point where, looking at Sharanjit there in the audience, that it's simply the insurance product becomes unaffordable, unavailable, and as an industry, we lose our social license to operate because people can't afford product. So, adaptation. And there's probably three parts to this. This is like a 30-page presentation smushed into one slide. First and foremost is our bread and butter, which is risk transfer. Both insurers and reinsurers seeking to essentially be that financial safety net behind individuals, governments, and corporations. Moving then into a more innovative form, which is parametric insurance. So less dealing with individual household or asset vulnerability, but looking to ways to make insurance more accessible, potentially more affordable. And then the role of insurance, of course, in construction. If people are actually going to undertake infrastructure projects for adaptation, they need to be able to insure it. So construction, engineering, delay in startup, all of that becomes very important in a role. We also believe there is an essential role in terms of data insights and sharing. So we do, in many cases, have very good models, and we try and partner a lot with government and public sector organizations who have access to excellent data as well, to really try and improve information on exposure, hazards, and vulnerability. And the Hazards Insurance Partnership being a very good example of that, where I think the Australian insurance industry is partnering with NEMA and others to not only bring data insights, but really have an open conversation about where this adaptation mitigation really needs to take place. I think the leaving the other pieces, but maybe talking particularly about this idea of how do insurers and reinsurers see their role in actually funding adaptation. We do not, I mean, talking generically for the insurance industry, it's not necessarily our role to build levies, but we understand and appreciate that part of that insurance premium price signal is a motivating factor to assist with and facilitate adaptation. And now we see, I guess, some innovation into this space in terms of using premium savings in particular to facilitate some and drive some of this adaptation. It's more pilot cases at the moment. Those of you who haven't downloaded the Resilient Building Council Bushfire Hazard app should do so, because not only does it give you a lot of information about your bushfire risk at your house, but potentially if you undertake some of those adaptation activities to reduce your house risk, you can qualify for a substantial premium saving from IAG and other insurers. There's a few other pilot cases around the world that I can talk to as well. I think the other piece in terms of kind of direct resilience building is the Build Back Better initiatives. Probably the most commonly known one referred to is Flood Re, but there's a number of other, innovations and changes in that area too.
Great. I think that comment on insurance premium discounts being an incentive for some homeowners leads nicely into Ben's perspective. So, you bring a very unique perspective in decision science. And so what makes these adaptation decisions so complex, so hard to pull the trigger on? And are those challenges the same for different decision makers, insurers, investors, individuals?
Thanks, Ramona. If you want to put this slide. So I think there are certainly, the headings seem to have not transferred over, but don't worry about that. I've got your headings in my slide. That's all right. The headings were supposed to be, I think, uncertainty, framing and plausible futures. So just imagine that that's what the headings are. That's what they were when I sent the slide. uncertainty is part of the game, right? I think so. To answer the last part of that question, are these factors the same for individuals, investors, insurers, and so on? I think that the underlying psychological factors are common, right? The people making those decisions in those different contexts are all people. They're all subject to the same kinds of decision processes that get involved when you're trying to weigh up the costs and benefits of these different sorts of decisions. Obviously, the stakes that are involved are massively different, and the sorts of information that's available to those different actors is going to be massively different. But I think the themes that I wanted to pick up on in the context of how we start getting people to think about what adaptation means, think about what taking action can actually mean, whether that be right down at the individual changing things in their house or at the level of investors making some serious investment in infrastructure or whatever it might be, that one of the things that we all want but is hard to get in these situations is certainty. And so dealing with the uncertainty in all of these decisions is very hard. And so that first box there highlighted some work that we did at the Institute for Climate Risk and Response in conjunction with colleagues in the Center of Excellence for Climate Extremes, to talk about how you actually deal with the kinds of uncertainty that is inherent in climate models and climate projections when you're trying to make decisions about planning and adaptation type actions. And this trade-off between people wanting precision, but sometimes seeking precision that is inaccurate. So the dartboard on the slide there is supposed to be illustrating the fact that you can be in a situation where all your darts are very tightly clustered around a particular point, but it's the wrong point. So they can be very precise. They can all be in the same area, but they're not going to be accurate. And there's a temptation, I think, in some of these decisions that people want to make, that they want that number. They want to be able to know what it is that they need to put into their particular model, their particular projection. And those numbers are not really there. So we need to really be aware that the precision that we're after for these longer term projections is not there at the moment, which means we need to think about different ways of making these adaptation type decisions. And that can be true for the homeowner, and it can be true for the investor. I think the second box there about framing is just a simple illustration that numbers that are kind of mathematically equivalent are not psychologically equivalent. So you can express a risk in different ways, which will have a significantly different impact on the decisions that people will make. So if I give those two ways of expressing the risk of a flood to someone in an experiment, then the second way of framing that, the lower one, will lead to people being more willing to take up insurance within the context of the experiment. And even in field studies as well, this has been shown to, you know, change people's willingness to adopt insurance products. So those are simple little changes that kind of feed into the way that people tend to think about how risk plays out. These are complex topics that a lot of us don't spend our time thinking about. And then the last part of the slide there is the idea that we need to be comfortable with a range of future possibilities. And this is, again, going back to the first point, that we can't have the precision that we might want, and therefore we need to start entertaining what these different plausible futures could be. We need to build in expertise from across lots of different areas when we're making these kinds of decisions, and be content with the fact that I can't give you it's a 20% chance that we're going to be in this future, or a 50% chance that we're going to be in that future, but these are the plausible futures that we might be in. And if we are at that point, these are the kind of actions that we could be taking. These are the decisions that we should be making, could be making, rather than putting that off. And I think this is really interesting from the broader investment perspective, rather than saying, well, we don't know about that over there, so I'm not going to think about it. We need to be thinking about it and thinking, if we get to that point, what are the set of actions that we have in front of us that we will be needing to execute? So it's thinking about that pathway, that sort of dynamic, adaptive pathway that we need to be on, that will trigger a particular decision at a particular point, rather than saying it's too uncertain, it's too far in the future, I don't want to deal with it.
So, sincere apologies for the slide, but I think those points about uncertainty, framing and plausible futures ring true in a lot of contexts. We're going to have a group discussion now and open to the audience, encourage you to submit questions via the mic or the app. But we'll open with this question around one of the challenges that comes up a lot in adaptation investment is that the benefits are often avoided losses at some uncertain time in the future, rather than other actions you could take that would generate immediate returns. So I'm wondering, open to the panel, what different perspectives are on this. Ben, you've touched on some of these decision-making challenges. Are there ways around that? Is it a barrier we can get over?
Yeah, I guess I'm happy to take this initially. I mean, I think that, yes, there's a lot of the psychological research would point to things like present bias, the idea that we're more likely to focus on what's in front of us right now and discount future outcomes more than we should. I think making a kind of normative claim about that and calling it a bias is perhaps a little bit unfair to us as a species. I mean, there's a reason why we need to focus on the current and make these kinds of decisions. But I do think that different ways, again, of clarifying and discussing and thinking about what are the costs of inaction are ways to make it more concrete for why we need to take action now. And yes, all right, it might be avoided losses, but I think that if you look at what we're all sort of driving towards, which is, coming off emissions reductions pathways that aren't like a black run, ski run, but are more like a green or something, an easy one, then we have to start getting those things in place. And so I think it's about unpacking the connection between making this choice and its impact on a future cost. And I think, as Alison was saying, the challenge at the moment when you think about the insurance decisions that people are making at an individual level, which is really an immediate upfront cost. I've got to do something substantial to my house in order to make it more resilient. And tying that to a reduction in my premium is a really good way to go, even though, as we were discussing at lunch, it's not going to be a reduction that is going to cover the cost of making that change immediately, but it is going to put me in a better position in the future to adapt to the kinds of changes that are coming. So making those links, making it clear what it is you're avoiding by taking this action, I think is essential.
I wouldn't mind adding to that. So I think part of your question was around if we don't have a kind of revenue generation as a result of making this investment or doing this activity, you know, what's the impetus? If it's avoided losses, you know, what's the impetus for getting those funds and those activities flowing? Globally, and this is true in Australia as well, what we're seeing is that when people or businesses or households have access to the information and the risks are salient for them, they tend to make reasonable, or they tend to make more action based on the resources that are available to them and a whole bunch of other on a whole bunch of other factors. And clearly the way that you express that information is very, very influential. But the basic pattern of information and resource availability is incredibly predictive of action. And so you've kind of got, in terms of adaptation activities, we think of it in a bunch of ways. You've kind of got, you know, the hardening of an asset that might be just meaning that if it gets hit by a hazard, it isn't hurt. You've got kind of resilience of productivity, which might be something like changing the crop on a farm so that it can continue to grow under different water conditions. And then you've also got adaptation solutions, which might be a company that has that can sell a service that makes a business more resilient to heat. And so for each cost, well, not for each cost, but for many costs to a business, there's probably another business that can provide a service. Now, is that necessarily improving human thriving? There's a question in there, but there's a potentially an investment opportunity that can be that if you accept that climate is going to get worse, you can make a profitable investment from adapting and building resilience to the climate realities that are in place. I don't know if that quite answers your question, but I think it's relevant and kind of builds on what Ben was saying.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing is that it's not an insurmountable barrier, the fact that you have to outlay cash and the benefits come some time down the track. You've all raised some good ways that can be overcome, like via insurance premium discounts or the kind of building out of an ecosystem where kind of new business opportunities arrive as a result of adaptation. Should we talk about some other success stories? And I wonder, would you like to share examples of, you know, great adaptation solutions that have been commercially viable? Alison, are you happy to start?
Sure. So I'd probably talk a little bit about some parametric insurance examples. So I think very much tying back into this idea of using, readily accessible, swiftly paid insurance to benefit wider communities. So there's some interesting innovations, for instance, coming out of India. Swiss Re has partnered with ICICI Lombard, one of the local insurers, to provide a parametric heat stress solution to working self-employed women's associations in districts of India, because a lot of that work is done outside in extreme heat. If there is a combination of very long extreme heat days, one after the other, it's not possible for these women to generate income. So it was a relatively simple parametric structure that allows a payout that can be used to supplement the lost income for these women during periods of extreme heat stress. I think it was initiated in 2024 and has already paid out a small amount and now expanded to other districts. So this is a way where the The adaptation technique is essentially a risk transfer supplement. It doesn't necessarily replace trying to change the physical environment at the same time. There's, for instance, another example in New York post ex-tropical hurricane Sandy, of using parametric flood insurance to provide emergency assistance for low-income areas who would need that emergency assistance immediately post-flood.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to mention that it's not really a success story, but I think the relationship between these different sorts of insurance products or ways of insuring people and the provision of private insurance versus, I know we're focusing on commercial, but a government kind of scheme. I think there's lots of very interesting discussion currently in the academic literature about this, the way in which you can optimize people's uptake of insurance, given that there might be additional government insurance. And in fact, to shine a light on him, my colleague Tobias, who's sitting in the audience from School of Risk and Actuarial at UNSW, he and I are about to run an experiment that's looking at precisely this issue. So what will be the uptake of a kind of simple way to insure in an experimental context if you also have in place some kind of additional coverage that will kick in after a certain size of a loss, effectively? And the interesting questions are, to what degree will people's uptake be crowded out by this presence of an additional option? So that might cover me in the big disaster, but it won't cover me in smaller ones. But does the presence of it being there mean that I'll reduce my coverage overall, which could actually be a suboptimal thing to do? And so working out where that point is that people would be willing to take up, or how big that additional coverage would need to be, I think is an interesting way of figuring out this broader question of how are we going to keep insuring people in situations where it's becoming increasingly unaffordable. The adaptation actions that people need to take might also be unaffordable, and therefore we have to have a kind of compromise set up.
I think that leads really nicely into a question from the audience, which is the role of government here. And we may have members of government in audience. And yeah, just want to give a nod to the amount of work that came up in the plenary that's been done in policy spaces. Guy DeBell mentioned a lot of these policy frameworks. Many of those actions are going to mitigation, capacity investment schemes, sector pathways of focus on mitigation. But zooming in on adaptation, what role can government play to create the right incentives for individuals, corporates, investors to do more in adaptation?
So the government... there's the National Climate Risk Assessment and the National Adaptation Plans. The National Adaptation Plan is a concept that goes up into the Paris Agreement on Climate Change. And the government has done its first pass of the National Climate Risk Assessment, and it said something that was, I think, really very important, which was that adaptation will need to be mainstreamed. So institutional investors have been expecting that the main version of the National Climate Risk Assessment and the National Adaptation Plan, we're expecting that to be released by now, and that will be a big driver of awareness. It should have some new information. It should have some actions that large parts of the economy can, in fact, start to mainstream adaptation in the way that the government has quite rightly identified is needed. So institutional investors are very keen for the National Adaptation Plan and the National Climate Risk Assessment to be released, for it to be put up in lights, for it to be funded, legislated and regularly updated. We have heard from government that adaptation will be a priority for this term. And so we're really kind of optimistic that there'll be some action on that pretty soon, you know, in the next little while, if not yesterday.
I was going to mention the same thing about the adaptation plan being a potential driver and that a lot of people are waiting for it. I've heard, I don't know whether they're government people in the room, I've heard some things that were less encouraging about what's going to be in it, but I'm not sure how much stock to put by that.
I'd maybe more generically add that there's some really good information for disaster risk resilience that $1 spent pre-disaster in adaptation might be worth a reduction of anywhere from $3 to $20, depending on what adaptation activity is undertaken in a post-disaster scenario. Now, given that government, in many cases, if there is no insurance, will be left, government, by the way, being us, right? We're the taxpayers, will be left picking up that bill. Getting the information and transparency out there, I think, is super important. And at the end of the day, individual or corporate are not able to do adaptation at landscape or major scale. That's the role of government.
We've got another question from the audience, which is, are there any adaptation measures you'd like to call out that are not being adopted but you believe should be scaled up and used more readily? Or, you know, I guess a practical recommendation for people in the room who want to start getting more into this area.
I have a personal bugbear, I'll admit it, which is excessive use of black or grey infrastructure over green infrastructure. I do think there's some excellent case studies coming out now around use of nature-based solutions, things like leaving the mangroves or replanting them along the coastlines to prevent flooding. Super effective. Coral reefs are shown to be more than 90% effective, for instance, in reducing the impact of storm-driven waves. And this kind of nature-based both preservation and restoration, I think, is something that we need to be way more conscious of, also because it doesn't make the carbon situation worse.
I think one, I don't know whether it counts as I think it probably does. I mean, we talk about the Build Back Better, but there's also the don't build in the wrong place first move, which is something that I think government, you know, needs to be a leader on for the reasons that we were discussing before. And so I think that anything that encourages that kind of new building that is not in areas that we know are going to be, or we have a good, you know, some degree of certainty about the risk that they're going to be in the future, really is a no-brainer. And it's obviously difficult when you're trading that against housing crisis and housing affordability and need for new builds. But it does seem, if we can be sure of anything, it's putting something in a floodplain. If it's a floodplain now, it's probably going to be a floodplain later.
Yeah, I saw a
kind of sad photograph circulating after the recent floods, which was a kind of new development approved sign on a, you know, half underwater. The billboard was half underwater. Now we're coming to the end of the session. And there are still time to get questions in, but given the audience and the conference we're at, the obvious question is, what's the role of actuaries in this problem? I probably won't. I'll give you some time to think, Ferg. But Alison, maybe we start with you.
Absolutely key. So we are I think embedded at the heart of most insurers. So I'm speaking really from an insurance and reinsurance perspective. We are embedded into the heart of that risk analysis, that pricing signal, all the information. We don't operate in a vacuum. We need to listen to the scientists and we need to work very closely with the extended team of people who have other expertise as well to essentially put a number to it and help, for instance, inform where the highest value adaptation activities can take place and put forward some of these dollars of what the savings will be in future risk. I actually also personally think that there is an important role for actuaries to bring forward the social cost, because when a house is flooded and inhabitable because of black mold, that is the stress, the strain and the personal impact on the affected people is not something you can readily put a dollar on, but it is just as important.
Yeah, I would agree with all of those points and moreover that the position that actuaries are in at that sort of bridging between understand, even if you can't put a precise number on it sometimes, but understanding the implications and having access to the data that is really driving a lot of these decisions is absolutely crucial. And so making it clear that is a role that can be played and it is a role that really drives an understanding of the broader case for adaptation is crucial.
Thank you for giving me the time to collect my thoughts. And your observation that I'm entirely unqualified to provide any prescriptions to actuaries is right. But I guess I'd make some observations that I think are relevant for actuaries as much as they are for many, many professions. Obviously this is a present challenge and there are present opportunities. But there are also going to be new dynamics, and that means uncertainties. So the work that Ben does is crucial. There's also going to be a need for innovation and collaboration, which are often tightly linked across disciplines. So developing and flexing those skills, I think, is a really useful thing for actuaries and everybody else to do. And also just getting expert or at least comfortable with change. So that to the extent that I can make any recommendation, that would be it for actuaries.
Look, I think that's a great set of recommendations, and you could easily be an actuary, I think. Yeah, we would welcome you. But it's been a great session today. That was a compliment. I think we've heard a range of different views, which reflects the fact that this is a problem that touches all of us in our work lives, out of work lives, whatever sector or part of the economy you're working in. We've heard some common challenges, this issue of having to deal with the uncertainty, the fact that we want precision and we want an upfront return, but somehow we need to get past that barrier, put a number on, not just the physical costs, but those harder to quantify costs, and bring that into our decision. But also, I guess, incentivize and make it sensible for investors or for an insurance policy holder to make it easier for them to make that decision through. We didn't get on to tax, but, maybe that's a panel for next year's summit. Thanks for joining us. If you would like to meet the panellists and say a few words after, please come up and say hello. Thanks, everyone.